This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh, yeah. Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Good morning. You are listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 8:55 a.m. with me, Priya, and with Inez.
Woohoo!
How's it going?
I'm moving at a snail's pace today. I'll tell you that for nothing.
Well, thank you.
I'll tell you something else for $1. I've been troubling with sleep.
I was going to say I don't have any change on me, but go on.
Just having trouble with sleep. I don't know how to do it. It's been, I don't know, like 5 years. Still can't do the Wednesday night sleep, but I so enjoy waking up and being here with you. How are you, Ria?
Well, speaking of sleep, I have an update, which is also a grievance. I don't know if people have been hearing this sound lately. If that sounds familiar to you, what you are hearing is actually the sound of a bird called the common coal or eastern coal. And it, oh boy, you know, as with many, many problems, it is a man who's trying to get some. And
oh my goodness.
These are actually migratory birds that migrate from eastern Indonesia and Papua New Guinea to northern parts of this continent to breed in the summer, like towards the spring and summer months. But they're going further and further south, I think, because of climate change. And so these little dudes are all up in the areas.
Oh my God, the original passport bros.
In my suburb, yelling at ladies from 6 p.m. to like 7 a.m., consistently, very, very loud. And also, they're kind of cuckoo. And so, you know what cuckoos do. They will wait for other birds to make a nest and then lay an egg and wait for their chick to hatch. And the other bird will raise their chick and they'll kick out all the other chicks. And the other bird will be like, I don't know why my son looks so weird. But
we love a blended family, though, on the
we
show.
We do love a blended family, but not one where one sibling kills all the other siblings.
Right, yes. Right, of course. So that would be
not ideal.
Yes.
But if you are hearing those sounds, just letting you know, that's the culprit. And also in a couple of months, if you see some magpie larks or red wattle birds with one weird son, that's probably what's going on.
And look out for him, you know. I think he needs to be part of his community and be ingrained in the culture.
But I also think that he needs to kind of learn about what community means.
Absolutely.
You know? And
transformative justice circle. What's exactly happening with you, brother?
What's happening with you, brother? Is it possible for you to just contribute to the community without killing all of your siblings, you know?
Yeah. We'll work on it. We'll work on it.
We're working on it. It's not much to ask for, but, you know, maybe it is a lot to ask for. And with that, we have a packed show for you today. So first of all, we are going to hear some reflections from writer, artist, and 3CR's Disability Day coordinator, Pauline Vatuna, on the work of disabled oracles in transforming the world in the wake of the recent passing of revolutionary disability activist Alice Wong. So I'm really keen to hear from Pauline on this. I know that Alice's passing has rippled around the world and had such a massive impact on people just because of the extraordinary community work that she has done for so many years in the disability justice space. And after that, we're going to hear from Fiona York, who is the Executive Officer of Housing for the Aged Action Group. And Fiona is going to speak with us about the ways that housing stress manifests for older people in the Victorian rental market and how this relates to poverty and also to different types of rental tenure. And we're going to talk as well about the impact of the government's public housing high-rise redevelopment program and how it's already been affecting older people living in the flats.
And then we'll hear an excerpt of a speech from myself, who is a member of Free Palestine Melbourne, who spoke at the community protest held against the Israeli Psytrance-infected mushroom on Monday, the 3rd of November at the Forum Theatre. Free Palestine Melbourne had written a letter to the Mariner Group, who manage and operate the Forum, and five other popular venues, who declined the request to cancel the concert. And we hear from my speech across the road from the Forum on a rainy night amongst counter-protesters, extra venue security, and of course, as always, Victoria Police escorts. And then we will have in studio a ongoing campaign for Save CoHealth, and Liz will be providing the updates, who's a doctor and a member of Socialists in Healthcare. We will have an event tomorrow on the Healthcare Workers Speak Out, tomorrow at 4:30 opposite Peter Mac Hospital. And then on Sunday, the Save CoHealth Fitzroy protest, where we will be starting at CoHealth in Fitzroy and then marching to the Health Minister's office. So we're going to be talking about what the campaign is, how to join it, and what to expect.
Yeah, and we will have information in our show notes so that you are up to date with everything that's going on and know where to show up. And finally, we'll be joined by Dr. Simon Bradshaw, who is the COP31 lead at Greenpeace Australia Pacific. And Simon's going to join us live from COP30 in Belém in Brazil with updates from the conference as it reaches its close this week. Now, while Australia is continuing to angle for the privilege of hosting COP31, obviously there are very serious questions remaining about climate finance commitments and concrete action on an end to fossil fuels, and also about the potential and pitfall of hosting here when it comes to questions of either greenwashing Australia's terrible climate record or creating opportunities for protests and direct action and international scrutiny. So stay tuned, and we'll be back with you shortly with the news headlines.
Don't have $1 million and still want to have a good education for your kid? Tune into the Dogs program. We are the defenders of government schools. 12 p.m. on Saturdays here on 3CR. 855 on the AM dial podcast. Streaming live on 3cr.org.au and 3CR digital. We defend government schools because they need it.
These are the news headlines for Thursday, the 20th of November. Israel has carried out new strikes in Lebanon yesterday and this morning in the town of Anata and El Hawi refugee camp, killing at least 14 people. Now, in El Helwai is the largest Palestinian refugee camp in Lebanon. Additionally, Mahmoud Basal, the spokesperson for the Gaza Civil Defense, reported a sharp escalation in Israeli attacks across the Gaza Strip, resulting in multiple casualties in several areas such as Rafah and Khan Yunis. In the occupied West Bank, the Israeli army has imposed a full curfew yesterday on the town of Beit Umar, declaring it a closed military space, stopping ambulances, vehicles and residents from moving around the town with positioned snipers on multiple seized properties. Al Jazeera and the Palestinian Prison Society reports that around 150 to 200 town residents have already been detained. As of today, Israel has carried out 393 attacks in violation of the latest ceasefire, killing 280 people and wounding 672. In Sudanese news this week, UN officials have called for greater access to Al-Fashir, where tens of thousands of residents are believed to be trapped, cut off from aid, healthcare services and other crucial supplies. Since the RSF seized control of Al-Fashir in late October this year from the Sudanese armed forces, more than 100,000 people have fled the city to nearby towns and displacement camps, according to the latest UN figures. Now, survivors have described seeing bodies lining up the streets, while researchers in the United States say satellite images suggest RSF forces are burying bodies in mass graves. Meanwhile, the paramilitary group has been pressing eastward into the neighboring Kordofan area, where the UN High Commissioner for Refugees has reported intensified airstrikes, drone attacks, and heavy troop mobilization since early November.
In Gugatha country, so-called South Australia, in a media release published yesterday afternoon, supporters of senior Gugatha elder Auntie Sue Hazeldine have demanded action and transparency about Southern Launch's rocket testing plans, which pose an imminent threat to her safety as she undertakes cultural activities on country. Supporters hold grave concerns about the safety of Auntie Sue, who is currently on Gugatha Country and within the designated Kunibba test range operated by Southern Launch. Despite directly seeking confirmation and details of the planned launches from Southern Launch, the Australian Space Agency and relevant government authorities this past weekend, Auntie Sue has received no further clarity about the situation. Southern Launch has also failed to publish information about the rocket launch schedule during the designated period for this activity between the 6th of October and the 30th of November 2025. In yesterday's media release, Auntie Sue reiterated that there is no consent for rocket testing on Gugatha Country, saying, quote, "My country is not a military zone. It is an important place culturally, spiritually, and environmentally. We've been battling for a long time for the protection of country, and this battle continues here today. Any company or government agency that decides they're going to use my country as their playground for warfare, for testing their war materials, they're not welcome," end quote.
In legal news this week, adults and children as young as 10 years old could be forced to face court without legal representation unless they're already in jail, as Legal Aid Northern Territory takes, quote, "drastic action" to address projected funding deficits. A letter seen by the ABC has revealed that the Legal Aid NT will stop offering free legal representation to people charged with a crime unless they are already in custody, under a new policy that took effect on Monday, the 16th of November. The chief executive of the NT's other legal aid service, the Northern Australian Aboriginal Justice Agency, has warned it's facing similar funding issues. Legal Aid NT Director Catherine Vomard said, while existing grants or extensions of aid for criminal clients who were not in custody would be honoured, new applications would be refused. The restrictions apply to adults and children across all stages of the court process, with the age of criminal responsibility in the NT now 10 years old after the Country Liberal Party government lowered it from 12 years old in October last year. This comes after months of turmoil where three board members resigned over NT Attorney General Marie-Claire Boothie's captain's pick to appoint Viss Robard to the role, rather than any other candidate that was recommended by the board. Now, the Productivity Commission states the NT youth detention numbers had been declining since January 2025, but have now more than doubled since punitive bail laws were introduced in April 2025. And in August of this year, the Commission reported that of the 60 young people in detention in the NT, 95% identified as Indigenous, which is the highest recorded number in the last 8 years. Now, disturbingly, 85% of young people in detention had not been sentenced, were on remand, or had a warrant pending.
And finally, in news headlines today, researchers at Curtin University have shared the dire results of their latest survey of Ningaloo Reef, Western Australia, which reveals that more than 60% of corals have died off across 8 surveyed sites. The devastating findings show that between March and October 2025, the number of living corals counted across the World Heritage Site has dropped from 1,600 to just 600. Scientists have been paying close attention to the rates of coral death after a record heat wave on the reef that has lasted since December 2024, resulting in mass coral bleaching and subsequent death. PhD candidate David Juskiewicz told ABC News that the full picture of coral bleaching and death on Ningaloo Reef was only visible when scuba diving, with some of the surveyed areas resembling a forest in the aftermath of a bushfire. As we head towards the summer months, scientists continue to sound the alarm about high ocean temperatures off the coast of Western Australia, which may result in serious consequences for the fate of surviving coral reefs. While there is still some hope that particular reefs and coral species may recover or adapt to warming waters, researchers continue to stress that preserving and protecting coral reefs around Australia's coastline fundamentally relies on urgent and sweeping cuts to greenhouse gas emissions. These have been the news headlines for Thursday, the 20th of November, and you're listening to 3CR 855 AM.
Hopefully we can protect everything that's worth protecting on country and keep all warmongers out. Well, I won't
back down. Gugatha elder Auntie Sue Hasseldine is fighting to protect her country from Southern Launch's rocket testing range. Southern Launch's collaborations with international weapons companies such as Thales, as well as the Australian Defence Force, are threatening sacred sites, endangered animals and unique ecosystems. Join West Mallee Protection letter writing calling on key decision makers to get Southern Launch off Gugatha country. For more information, visit West Mallee Protection on Instagram. West Mallee Protection is a 3CR supporter. And I won't
back down. You're tuned in to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is coming up to 7:15 in the morning, and we are now going to hear writer, artist, and 3CR's Disability Day coordinator, Pauline Vatuna, sharing some reflections on the work of disabled oracles in transforming the world in the wake of the recent passing of revolutionary disability activist Alice Wong. Pauline also reflects on the importance of critically attending to how we practice solidarity and community with disability justice at the core, disabled ancestorhood, and this year's upcoming Disability Day special broadcast, which will be held on the 3rd of December on 3CR 855 AM.
So firstly, I just want to thank you, Priya, for inviting me to share some words on the passing of who I think was one of the most important disability liberation and human liberation thinkers of our time. You asked me to begin by discussing the promise and pitfalls of appeals to solidarity and community through a disability justice lens. And so I think it's good to get some definitions on the table first. So disability rights in the Western world began with disabled people valiantly fighting their way out of institutionalization. And so efforts by disabled people and the people close to them to be able to access, you know, the basic amenities of living in society and live independently free from violence. So disability rights, to a large extent, is still about that. Disabled people or people with disabilities are still having to fight for access on so many fronts and so many levels of policy. Most notably in an Australian context, independent living and housing, healthcare, income support and accessibility to everything a human being needs to live a life and participate in society. So you can see from that disability rights is fighting for things that all people need, all pre-disabled people. Disability justice, however, takes it further. As a framework, it is inherently about liberation beyond what currently exists. So beyond colonial racial capitalism, beyond carceral systems, and beyond empire. So it's a broader agenda of change, and it recognises that not only are all people pre-disabled and deserve to live and have their needs met, that in order for that to be a reality, we have to radically challenge and change the very root of oppression, which necessitates that we develop coherent understandings of how all of these movements for justice are interconnected, and how oppression creates disability and debility on Earth, disabling not just people, but animals and ecosystems as well. So you can see in my basic definitions that the differences between them sort of mirror the differences between liberal notions of progressive human rights changes within existing institutions of society versus radical, ground roots up, materialist efforts of liberation beyond the institutions of colonial capitalism, the nation-state, and the whole international system. However, with disability and disabled lives, the line between those two is blurrier because of the nature of vulnerability under capitalism that disabled people face, because many disabled people are reliant on care and on the state in order to just live. We have to both fight for policy changes that affect our ability to simply exist, to get and maintain welfare, to get and maintain housing, healthcare, transport, basic community infrastructure, at the same time as we dream radically beyond what exists and try to build futures beyond eugenics and colonial capitalism. So circling back to your question again, all of these things that I just talked about require solidarity and community building. These are really the only ways that humans can get free. And disabled people know this more than most. So a lot of our advocacy has to, unfortunately, focus on, you know, helping pre-disabled people understand that their liberation can only come about with a thorough understanding of disability rights and disability justice into their freedom work. Because other than premature death, the major consequence of all forms of oppression is disability. It is the disabling of minds and bodies and spirits. So it really transcends all of our different identities, while at the same time our identities can make us bigger targets for violence in society, which is, you know, the essence of intersectionality. So disability rights and disability justice work is really deeply vulnerable work. It's really challenging. It requires levels of nuance and a breadth of understanding that I think actually makes disabled people real assets to human freedom. But ableism and eugenics is literally killing off some of the best amongst us. This is something Alice Wong talked about frequently, and she also embodied it. So yes, that does bring me to Alice Wong, who sadly passed away in a hospital from an infection this past week. She was just 51 years old. I personally describe her loss as unquantifiable. I think she was an absolute force of nature in disability rights and also championed disability justice, particularly in relation to Palestine and the ongoing genocide in Gaza. Alice was one of the disabled people behind Crips Free Sims for Gaza, which was a fundraising effort to purchase eSIMs for people in Gaza. And together they actually raised millions of dollars. Alice had actually spent a huge amount of time in hospitals over the past few years. And a lot of her advocacy in recent times centered on two big challenges: the genocide of the Palestinian people and the abandonment of medically vulnerable people through the removal of COVID mitigations, especially in medical settings. Alice was one of those vulnerable people. She needed people to mask around her, and consistently when not around her, because she couldn't mask herself due to a breathing apparatus she had to wear. During hospitalization, she faced doctors, nurses, other staff members and administrators not wearing respirator masks around patients, which is wild. Alice did not pull punches. She was loud about the insidious eugenics at the core of so much of the official public health policies concerning COVID and long COVID. I've actually seen an enormous outpouring of grief and gratitude from COVID-conscious people, including parents of medically vulnerable children who desperately need solidarity to stay safe. So Alice said over and over again, masking for others is community care. Now, if you search online for Alice Wong's work on any platform, you will find a massive digital history of her extensive efforts to publish and advance the stories, the perspectives, and the dignity of people with disabilities in the United States, where she was born. But she also supported disabled people across the English-speaking world. I met Alice in 2021, when we delivered a webinar together, and I really cherish that moment and that memory. She was incredibly generous with her encouragement and her wisdom, and I think the outpouring of grief and anecdotes being shared online is a testament to this. I think Alice's own writing was genius. I urge you to read her books and her essays, because she was a genuine visionary, and I think this is best experienced rather than spoken about. Having said that, though, I did read the words of a Black Irish disability advocate named Blessing Dada, who said this: seeing someone whose politics, body, culture, and survival strategies reflect yours. In her, I found a mirror, a mentor, and a map. What she meant to me is incomprehensible. She showed me that representation is not a luxury. It is survival. It is power. It is a form of care. She's left behind a blueprint for a radically accessible, interdependent, anti-eugenic, anti-colonial future. To honour her is to live more boldly into the world she envisioned. The task now is to transform the world in the direction she pointed. Now, Priya asked if I could talk about the Disability Oracle Society, and so in my remaining minutes with you, let me do so. So before she passed, Alice Wong had for a long time advanced this idea of disabled people being the seers, the oracles of the world. Those who can see things through pattern recognition, heightened sensitivity, alternative senses, intuition, before they happen. I think what she meant by this is that we have to attune so well to those who affect our lives, which is all non-disabled people, carers, institutions, political trends, that our survival depends upon our ability to see through time and perceive both the dangers and the opportunities of different courses of collective action we could take, and then use our voices and creations to warn others, herald good news, bring forth solutions to our biggest challenges as a species through time. So the Disabled Oracle Project is an archive of such transmissions from beyond time. It was founded by Alice Wong and some of her friends. One part of the project is a website featuring telegrams by disabled oracles to the world in the form of text, video, audio, and graphic art. It is a living chorus and archive of disabled wisdom from the past, present, and future. Now, the whole project was actually inspired by a talk that Alice Wong delivered back in 2020. It was called The Last Disabled Oracle, and it featured as part of the Assembly for the Future, which is a project of the Things We Did Next collaboration based here in NAM, actually, in Melbourne, Australia. And I actually broadcast that talk on the Disability Day broadcast in 2020. You can listen to it at 3cr.org.au/Disability Day 2020. And if you tune into this year's Disability Day broadcast on December 3rd, you will hear more disabled oracles. The theme this year is Right Relations and Innovations, and you can find the full program at 3cr.org.au/Disability Day 2025.
Thank you so much, Pauline, for sharing those beautiful and profound reflections and lessons, not just those of Alice Wong, but those of other disabled oracles and, a whole movement of disabled activists and disability justice warriors over time who have really been pointing us towards a future otherwise, and the revolutionary transformation of the world, which, as you talk about, has implications for all of us. Everyone who is not currently disabled is only pre-disabled. And so I really hope that people sit with what you've shared and go look at the Disability Visibility Project, the Disabled Oracle Project, and everything else that you have referenced. That was writer, artist, and 3CR's Disability Day coordinator Pauline Vituna sharing some reflections on the impact of revolutionary disability activist Alice Wong and on the work of disabled oracles in transforming the world, as well as the importance of critically attending to how we practice solidarity and community with disability justice at the core. And remember again to stay tuned to 3CR 855 AM on the 3rd of December for this year's Disability Day special broadcast. It is 7:28 in the morning.
Hi, I'm Jeffrey.
I'm Alphonse.
I'm Erwin.
And we are from the Voice of West Papua.
Tuesday 6:30 until 7:30 p.m.
News and music from West Papua.
It's the government's job to protect Australia's forests and oceans, but too often, governments put the interests of big corporations ahead of protecting your health, your climate, and your children's future. The Albanese government is about to change Australia's nature law. While this might seem like telling them how to suck eggs, we expect laws that actually protect nature by closing deforestation loopholes and protecting threatened species. It's literally their job. Head to wilderness.org.au/ suck eggs. To learn more, the Wilderness Society is a 3CR supporter.
If you're a renter with problems such as repairs, getting your bond back, negotiating a rent hike, or facing eviction, it helps to know your rights. For free information and advice on renting, you can visit Tenants Victoria at www.tenants.vic.org.au, Arnica Legal at www.anikalegal.com, or contact your nearest community legal centre. The government is planning to demolish and redevelop high-rise public housing towers in Melbourne. If you're living in a public housing tower and need free legal advice about your options, find your nearest community legal centre at www.fclc.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
You might have heard about the Community Radio Plus app, but it's only when you start using it that you'll wonder how you lived without it.
You can listen to us wherever you are, at home, work, driving,
on public transport, gardening, protesting, or even in the bath.
Just search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your app.
You're tuned in to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is 7:31 in the morning. And we are now joined by Fiona York, Executive Officer of Housing for the Aged Action Group, who's going to be speaking with us about the ways that housing stress manifests for older people in the Victorian rental market and how this relates to both poverty and to different types of rental tenure. And Fiona is also going to unpack some of the impacts of the government's public housing high-rise redevelopment program and how it's already been affecting older people living in the flats. Good morning, Fiona.
Morning. How are you going?
Good. How are you?
Not bad.
Yeah, well, thanks very much for joining us bright and early this Thursday morning. I wanted to begin by asking you about the rates of housing stress and poverty that you've seen for older people in Victoria. And, you know, how these impact the way that older people in Victoria are navigating different submarkets of the rental market in the state. So here I'm thinking about private rentals, but also public housing and community housing.
Yeah, so there's been a big shift in the demographics of older people over the last 10 or 15 years or so, where in the past there was an assumption that older people in retirement owned their own homes and they would be relatively stable in their own homes to be able to age well, receive aged care, all of those sorts of things. But we've seen a 78% increase in older renters in 10 years between 2011 and 2021. And of course, that census data was before COVID, so it's likely to be even worse now. So there's a small but growing cohort of older people that are living in private rentals, and a lot of them may have rented for life. There's probably a lot of listeners to 3CR that are in this boat that have always been renters, often in low-paid jobs. They might be, you know, cleaners and artists and musicians and all sorts of different types of people who never bought a home. And then there's also a cohort of people that have been in home ownership but have fallen out of home ownership through things like divorce or illness or perhaps having to leave the workforce later in life to care for their kids or care for their parents. So all of those things mean that there's more people living in unstable, insecure and poor quality private rental accommodation and increasing numbers of homelessness as well. So people that are couch surfing, sleeping in their cars, staying between their kids' places sometimes, and also sleeping rough. So lots of housing precarity, lots of people really struggling to make ends meet, falling into rent arrears with these unexpectedly high rent increases, and also living in really poor quality housing, which is affecting their health. So it's certainly not the picture that you see when you see the glossy brushes of people, you know, bowling and in swimming pools and things in retirement. That's not necessarily the case, and it's certainly not the people that are coming knocking on our door.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned private rentals, but I know that there are also a lot of older folks that are living in public housing and community housing. And I was wondering if you could speak to maybe some of the dynamics of rental tenure for older folks across those different types of tenancy.
Yeah, so our view is that that public housing is a good option for older people. And the reason for that is that rents are capped at 25% of their income and that they can live there as long as they need to, in perpetuity, basically, until they move into residential aged care or they pass away. So that type of housing is a really good, stable option, and often it's, able to be modified when they age as well. So if they need air conditioning or if they need ramps and rails, things like that, the government can provide that for older people. In community housing, we also have a lot of people that are living in community housing as well. And increasingly, there's been a shift from responsibility for providing low-cost housing from the government to the community housing sector, to the registered community housing providers. And they're a bit of a mixed bag. There's some really great ones that our kind of members and former clients are quite happy living in. The rent is higher, though. It is usually 30% of their income plus Commonwealth rent assistance, and then there's often bills involved as well. So that can be a bit of a shock for someone that has lived in public housing. But both of those options are much better, in our view, than private rental, where leases are short, rents are high, housing quality is low. So we, in our service, try to get people out of private rental into public and community housing.
And when you talk about the duration of leases, I think this is an important thing to consider when we think about the benefits of ageing in place. Now, for people who aren't really familiar with what that means, can you talk about what ageing in place actually looks like and why it is such a protective factor for people as they age?
Yeah, so it's really, really important for people to be able to stay in a stable home environment when they get older, and there's a range of reasons for that. So people need to be able to access their health services, they need to be able to be familiar with the public transport, access to their friends and family, all of those things in the community, which makes it really important for people to be able to age well, in that they can have a social life, they can receive care in the home, they can have enough money left over to pay the things that they need to pay for. Without those things, we see high levels of physical and mental ill health and stress, and we also see really big financial burdens. So it means that people aren't able to receive the Commonwealth-funded aged care services in the home if they're moving around a lot. Also, the cost of moving is really high. Having to move every 12 months in a private rental situation when you're in your 70s and 80s is really not okay. And moving people away from the familiar surroundings has a big impact as well. So sometimes we have clients come to us that only want to live in the suburb that they've always lived in, because that's what they know, but there's just no housing there. And so they don't want to move away from their daughter or their son or their grandkids or their doctor. And it's a real issue that we don't have enough housing choices all across Victoria to enable people to stay where they need to stay. The impacts on older people are particularly acute. It's much, much harder to adapt and just even physically to be able to do all of the things involved in moving. So that's why it's really important that people do have that long security of tenure to be able to let them age well.
Yeah, absolutely. And on that, I wanted to turn to the government's high-rise redevelopment plans. Now, I know that there are 13 high-rises that are reserved for over 55s, but also that older people live across the other towers as well. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask about both the importance of those towers, but the impacts that the redevelopment program has had on older tenants that you're starting to see.
Yeah, we are really supportive of the 55-plus housing. It used to be called elderly persons units, but they don't call it that anymore. And there are 13 towers, but there's also a lot of low-rise public housing that's dedicated to people aged 55-plus as well. And in terms of people's kind of, feeling of safety and well-being, those types of housing is really good, living in a community of older people. And it also enables people to be able to access services pretty easily as well. So We know that there's lots of older tenants that are in the high-rises that are nervous about what's going to be happening with the redevelopment. However, they've been told it's a way off, and so a lot of people are thinking, well, maybe that won't happen to me. But in the meantime, yes, there's lots of people in the towers who are under redevelopment as well. And I guess the biggest impact for them is being moved out of their communities and where they know. So ideally, we would like to see much more support for older tenants in the high-rises, whether they're at the older person's high-rises or the general stock, given all of the things that I just mentioned before about how difficult it is for people to move and to be taken away from their families and communities.
And I did want to ask, you know, we have had an extended discussion over the past few years about the lack of consultation with residents before the announcement that the towers were going to be redeveloped. I wanted to ask, can we get a general sense of the extent to which older people in housing stress get to have a say about the decisions made about their housing, their independence and their access to supports?
Yeah, I think generally across all government policy areas, there's not a great deal of consultation for the people that are affected by those policies. And definitely housing is one of them. I mean, if you're in private rental, you have zero say, basically. And although there has been consultations to some extent in terms of it's in terms of the redevelopment, it's been around kind of the values and things rather than the practicality. And what we've been told is that people want to know what's going to happen, what's the timeline, what's the reasoning for it. And there hasn't really been much of that. I'm hoping that will change. I'm really hoping that with the parliamentary inquiry other sort of things that are happening in this space, that the voices of tenants will be much more listened to, and that they're not just listened to, but actually had action. Like, the results of their consultation shouldn't just be like, thank you, we've heard that and we're going to go on with business as usual. I think people need to be able to have influence into the policy decisions that are affecting them, which means that, yes, it might take longer and it might be uncomfortable sometimes for people to hear things that they don't want to hear. But if we're going to be sort of genuinely listening to the voices of tenants, then we need to be able to listen to all of those voices, whatever they say.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, it's definitely a tough one, and I understand that it is definitely going to take longer, particularly from people who might have, language barriers, they might not speak English, they might need interpreters. All of those things take time, but in order to respect and listen to those voices, we need to take that time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, for any decision that is made with the presumption of having the best interests of people in mind, especially when it comes to older people who often have their agency dismissed, I think this is really an important issue. And now, finally, I wanted to just ask, before we wrap up, Fiona, do you want to tell us about an event that we've got coming up next week?
Yeah, so it's the Dwelling Justice Forum at RMIT next Wednesday night at 6 o'clock, and it's going to be the screening of a documentary about Barak Beacon Estate, which is a public housing estate that was redeveloped in Port Melbourne, and some of the people that are in the film are HAG members, including probably most famously Margaret Kelly, who was the last tenant in the place before it was demolished. Spoiler alert. So that will be screened, and then there'll be a panel discussion with a number of different people that are picking up the tenants, I guess.
Yeah, awesome. And I mean, I shouldn't talk about this as if I'm not involved. This is
I was going to say, Priya, yeah. You know about this.
Yeah, no, this is part of a research project that I'm involved in with Professor Libby Porter and Dr. David Kelly. And we're hoping as well that the panel discussion, which Fiona will be a part of, along with other folks from Homeless Persons Union and people who live in public housing, who are public housing advocates, will be able to bring together some of the important issues around housing and homelessness and really, you know, the right to dwell in this place. So thank you so much, Fiona. I'm really looking forward to next week.
Yeah, thanks, Priya.
And that was Fiona York, Executive Officer of Housing for the Aged Action Group, who spoke with us about housing stress for older people in the Victorian rental market and the impacts of the public housing high-rise redevelopment program on older tenants. And you can catch Fiona on 3CR's Raise the Roof program every Wednesday from 5:30 to 6 p.m. and hear her in conversation with other housing justice advocates in next week's From Housing Crisis to Dwelling Justice event at RMIT University in the city. And we'll have information on how you can grab a ticket in our show notes. Now, Inez, I might go straight to you for our next segment.
Yeah, sure. We'll hear an excerpt of a speech from May Saf, who is a member of Free Palestine Melbourne, who spoke at the community protest held against the Israeli Psytrance infected mushroom on Monday the 3rd of November at the Forum Theatre. Now, Free Palestine Melbourne had written a letter to the Marina Group, who manage and operate the Forum, as well as five other popular music venues, who had declined to request to cancel the concert. So we hear from the speech as well as all the background from the Forum on a rainy night, countless counter protesters, extra venue security, and of course, as always, Victoria Police escorts. But take a listen to, yeah, this important speech.
Okay, our first speaker tonight, nearly everybody here will know her, but I still have to introduce her because it's May Saif from Free Palestine Melbourne.
To be quiet today. We're here to be very, very loud, and we're going to be here to stand in solidarity with Palestine, but in particular, we want to show them that the arts cannot be bought and co-opted. I'd like to first take a moment to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people, the Kulin Nation, on which we meet and stand here today, pay my respects to their elders past, present and emerging, and recognise that we are standing on colonised unceded land that experienced its own genocide, ethnic cleansing, destruction of culture and identity, and also the cultural appropriation of its own culture and identity. It's extremely important to recognise when we're standing in a colonised land that there is a story that is shared across the world, and it is shared with the people of Palestine. I find it extremely entertaining, actually, that there's a bunch of Zionists standing across from us who have used culturally appropriated music to play right back at us. Not really able to present its own cultural reflections, it has to steal and supplant it from the indigenous population, the Palestinian people. Very entertaining. Thank you, guys. But I hope that you also hear that there are more of us who support Palestine who recognise that genocide has been committed, that the Israeli IDF or occupying force is a criminal army, that you stand with apartheid, ethnic cleansing and mass extermination of indigenous population, and you stand there dancing and celebrating about it. Yes, shame. And we here stand on the side of justice. We stand with people who believe in equal rights and humanity. We stand for people who have been oppressed and slaughtered and yet stand with dignity every day, caring for their communities and their families and their children. That we are the side that believes in supporting every single marginalized community. That we are the side that stands with anyone who's been othered, who's been sidelined, who's been oppressed. That's the side we stand on. Not those with money and power and bombs who think violence is the way to go, who think shooting children and snipering them is the way to go, who think dropping 8,000 ton bombs on civilians and hospitals is the way to go. And we're specifically here to show that infected mushroom, to be honest, I'd never heard of them before. I'm like, what the fuck is that? Apparently there's something, not here, not with the people who stand with justice. They are nothing but leeches who are willing to campaign and fund genocide. There is seriously something wrong with your moral clarity if that's the argument we're having today. But more importantly, we're here to also highlight that the genocide has not stopped. The daily bombing may have stopped, but the genocide continues. The occupation of Palestinian land homes our bodies. Our very existence has not stopped. Right now in the West Bank, we have people that have been forcibly evicted from their homes, who during the olive harvest have been attacked and beaten simply for trying to cultivate their own land. Right now in my own family's village, they cannot even go out into the streets at night because settler gangs roam the streets beating up people who come their way with guns and knives and sticks and any weapon. They've been given a free-for-all. Kill a Palestinian and you will be exempt. We're at a precipice where the very dehumanization of Palestinians means that people like this can come out proudly and think they will not be questioned. But we have said here in Melbourne and everywhere in the world have said, no, we will not be silenced. We will not be intimidated. We will come out for Palestine. And we have done this every single day for over 2 years. And every single day since the occupation started over 70 years ago. We have not stopped and we will not stop. So, since this isn't a family-orientated protest and gathering, I'd love to tell all you supporters over there of Infected Mushroom and the Israeli military Zionist machine that believes in ethnic cleansing, in genocide, and mass incarceration of civilians and the murder of children. Fuck you. Really want to tell you that. Fuck you. And anyone who knows me, I don't usually swear. I'm the tamest one amongst my family, actually. Not a great swearer, but goddammit, fuck you. So don't be afraid to come out and be vocal, because we are more in number than they are. They have been trying to intimidate and silence anyone who stands with Palestine, anyone who has a conscience, who questions the Israeli state and its policies. Because let's not forget, this is a state with policies and arms. It is not an individual. It has power. It dominates. And it uses that power to crush anyone who questions them. And it has waged war not just on the Palestinian people for decades, but on all of its neighbors. It is now in Syria and Lebanon. It is a violent state. And that is its policy. And anyone who can, we here in Australia can question the Australian government and its policies, well, we can damn well sure question the Israeli state. And we will take you to the International Criminal Court, but we will also hold you to account on our streets, in our courts. And we find you criminal. So f*** you, Israel, and free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
Free, free Palestine!
From the river to the sea!
Palestine will be free!
From the river to the sea!
That was absolutely fantastic. I think people need to know that the people who own the Forum Theatre, and we ask them very politely to cancel tonight's performance, the people who own it is the Mariner Group, and they own 5 theatres in central Melbourne. So maybe think twice before you buy a ticket for one of those theatres, because the Mariner Group is complicit in genocide, because it has consciously decided to go ahead with the Infected Mushroom gig tonight. And I'll say one thing. We were here, we did a small protest here a week and a bit ago. People were queuing down Hosier Lane all the way across the front of the Forum. I see very few people going in there tonight. I'd like to think this gig is going to be a huge flop. And the Mariner Group has spent a lot of money on security. I hope they lose money on this. And it adds to their decision never to hold a pro-Israel performance in this theatre again.
Infected Mushroom, yucky. That was May Saif, member of Free Palestine Melbourne, speaking at the community protest held against Israeli psytrance duo Infected Mushroom on Monday, the 3rd of November at the Forum Theatre. And Free Palestine Melbourne had written a letter to the Mariner Group, who manage and operate the Forum and five other popular venues, but they declined the request to cancel the concert. So we heard May speaking across the road from the Forum on the night of the concert amongst counter-protesters, extra venue security, and of course, Victoria police escorts. Now, speaking of important events, but this is one that you won't want to miss, Beyond the Bars is having its CD launch this, 20th of November, today. So this evening. So please join us for that launch. It's going to be an incredible event.
Fire! Hi, this is Cheryl Lee Hood. You're invited to the 2025 Beyond the Bars CD launch on Thursday, the 20th of November at the Deering Centre next to Collingwood Town Hall. Put it in your diaries. I'll be there as MC for an evening of talks and music, including a panel discussion with some of our deadly broadcasters and music with Mr. Bar Willoughby. Thursday, the 20th of November, the Deering Centre, next to Collingwood Town Hall, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. Free CDs, snacks and drinks provided. All welcome. See you there. Brrr.
Yes, please come on down. I'll be there. There'll be plenty of other 3CR programmers there. And most importantly, the incredible First Nations crew with Shirley Hood, the indomitable MC, will be there talking about and playing excerpts from the Beyond the Bar series this year. If you are just joining us this morning, we started off the show hearing from Pauline Batuna sharing some reflections on disabled oracles and the passing of revolutionary disability activist Alice Wong. And we also heard from Fiona York, Executive Officer of Housing for the Aged Action Group, speaking about the importance of housing security for older people, and especially the importance of access to public housing in the wake of the Victorian government's high-rise redevelopment program plans. And we just heard from May Saif from Free Palestine Melbourne speaking at the community protest against Infected Mushroom, the Israeli psytrance duo, on Monday, the 3rd of November at the Forum Theatre. Stay tuned and we will be with you shortly with the rest of our show on 3CR 855 AM.
Quando sono solo in casa e solo devo restare.
Benvenuti, benvenuti al programma Radio Filet.
Mercoledì pomeriggio dalle 18:30 alle 19:30.
And for those who don't speak Italian, that's Wednesday evening, 6:30 to 7:30 p.m.
You'll hear from multi-generational Italian voices coming together to connect and learn and discuss Italian culture.
And politics.
And politics.
Radio Filet, building bridges between the diaspora.
The program will be part in Italian, part in English. So
practice your Italian or hone your listening skills.
Radio Filet, la voce alternativa della comunità italiana a Melbourne.
Tune in to 3CR, 855 AM, or you can listen online, 3cr.org.au.
Radio Filet.
...3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings. Cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
If you're experiencing family violence, free legal support is available. You may need support with obtaining protection, setting up safe parenting arrangements, organising a new visa, getting into safe housing, or making sure bills and bank accounts are split fairly. Community legal centres have expertise in helping people who experience family violence and can provide confidential advice to help you understand your rights and legal options. reach out today for guidance and support, visit www.fclc.org.au and click Get Help to find a community legal centre near you. You don't have to face family violence alone. If you're currently in crisis, please contact Safe Steps on 1800 015 188. Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
The annual Melbourne Pacifica Festival is on again, 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Saturday, December the 6th, at the playground end of Banjo Paterson Park in Lynbrook. Immerse yourself in the richness of Pacific Island culture with traditional dance, dynamic drumming, soulful harmonies, bands, guest artists, children's activities including rugby clinics, Pacifica arts and crafts, and yummy food. Lots of fun and activities for the whole family. Saturday, December the 6th in Lynbrook. Visit melbournepacificafestival.org. Melbourne Pacifica Festival is a 3CR supporter.
Welcome back to 3CR Thursday Breakfast, and now we are joined by Liz, a doctor and member of Socialists in Healthcare, who joins us to provide Save CoHealth campaign updates, as well as what to expect from the upcoming events tomorrow on Friday, as well as on Sunday. Welcome, Liz.
Thanks very much for having me, Inez.
We have smiles on our faces in the studio because an hour ago we found out some breaking news. Liz, could you please tell us about what's happening with CoHealth?
So we've got some a bit of an update this morning. So basically, they have announced this morning that they are going. The Albanese government has pledged $1.5 million to pause the cuts to CoHealth and keep the clinics open, basically until mid next year. So that's a good thing. It's really excellent that all of the community pressure and all of the people in the community that have been out mobilising around these cuts has worked in forcing the Labor government to pause the closures. But obviously it's not the end. It doesn't mean that the clinics are going to keep operating long term. So it's really excellent, really good news for the community, but also just the start of a longer fight to maintain funding for these clinics and to make sure that they stay open long term.
Yeah, it's such beautiful news, but I remember hearing at a lot of the rallies and the protests that are filled with people and anger and devastation and, you know, a lot of power. But from memory, it was $4 million that we needed for short-term funding and $25 million for the long-term. Is that correct?
That's right. I think the updated figure that the article in The Age has put out this morning, I think, is now up to $7
million. Okay.
In terms of the funding gap. And then in addition to that, the Collingwood site, in my understanding, needs some pretty significant repairs that are also, I think, somewhere about $36 million in terms of the longer-term feasibility of keeping that site open. This is just really a small amount, a bit of a stopgap in terms of the larger amount of funding that's actually needed to keep the clinics open. But we say larger amount of funding, but in actuality, you know, something like, what, $43 million is such a drop in the ocean compared to the amount that we're shelling out on things like the AUKUS deal, which we're spending billions and billions of dollars on nuclear submarines that aren't going to benefit any everyday person in Australia. But somehow $43 million for these vital community clinics is too much.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The money seems to always be there, but going to very strange things. And I know that the cost of doing preventative care in community health, as we've mentioned before in our programming, that it is so much more cost beneficial, even if we remove people's lives and their health and their whatever, just from a point of figures number, the community health is more beneficial for the government than acute, you know, emergency room departments that are like 15 times the figure, correct?
Exactly. It's exactly right. 15 times. So basically a dollar spent in primary care is 15 times more financially efficient than money spent when patients end up in our emergency departments. So the chronic underinvestment in primary healthcare really is basically just what is crippling our public health system. It's a big part of the reason why our hospitals and our emergency departments are under such strain, because people can't see a GP or are delaying going to the GP because it's too expensive. And so then they end up in emergency departments with more advanced disease. They end up developing disease that otherwise they may not have.
Yep.
And there's also seems to have been a shift in a lot of funding for urgent care centres. So you might have seen there's urgent care centres popping up kind of all over the place. And I think three more of them due for rolling out in Victoria over the next few years. And again, urgent care centres, they don't provide general practice care. They don't provide primary care. They're also just a bit of a band-aid in terms of alleviating emergency departments by offloading patients.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't actually fix the underlying problem, which is that people need long-term community care that can understand their chronic conditions and dedicate the time to really looking after patients.
Yeah, absolutely. Like as you mentioned, like community health centres are not just GPs. It's counselling, it's refugee support, housing support, pharmacy, a lot of these are free and bulk billed. And I know if you're just tuning into the campaign, the GP centres are being closed in Fitzroy, Kensington and
Collingwood.
Yep, as well as the closure of the Collingwood site, which needs significant repair. So kind of speaking to both of those issues with the GP services as well as saving the centre. We have two events coming up, the Healthcare Workers Speak Out tomorrow, Friday, opposite the Peter Mac Hospital, as well as the Save CoHealth Fitzroy protest on Sunday at 1 p.m. at CoHealth in Fitzroy. Could you tell us a little bit more about, these two events and what it was like to, figure out why we wanted to do these next?
Yeah, so the reason that the government has had to provide this funding stopgap and pause the closures has been because the community has been so behind this issue and so outraged by the idea of these clinics closing. And two particular communities have been really active in this campaign. The first is co-health patients and people that live around where the clinics are. The clinics have serviced these areas for a long time. And the other portion of the population that's been really involved is healthcare workers who understand what a disaster these closures will be. So that's why specifically tomorrow we're having a healthcare worker speak out. It's at 4:30. We're going to stand on the roundabout outside where the Peter Mac hospital is, basically that big roundabout near all of the hospitals there, and have healthcare workers speak out, not just about the closures to these important clinics, but also just about the broader issue of underfunding and healthcare austerity and the increasing impacts and increasing problems we're seeing in healthcare as a result. And then for the Rally Sunday, that's a broader event for the community to stand together and say, it's great that we've paused the closures, but that's not enough. Labor, we demand that you properly fund these clinics and make sure they stay open. And better yet, we need an expansion of them and an expansion of our community health services in general. So we hope people can get along.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll put all that in our show notes as well. And I know there's been so many voices that we want to hear from. And, you know, it was really meaningful going to the rally in front of the Sarah Whitty's office, hearing from residents and workers and nurses. And I'm wondering in the organisation of all of this, how there's a lot of people that need a lot of support, and how are we getting their voices into the organizing space?
Yeah, it's actually been really amazing. All of the different voices and all of the different people that have gotten involved in this campaign, because obviously healthcare is an issue that pretty much affects everyone. And so it's been really amazing working with a lot of different members of the community, including activists in the Somali community space, activists around refugee rights, lots of obviously different voices in healthcare, a lot of people who do a lot of work around public housing activism. And so we will continue to basically have those voices present in the campaign. And there's certainly a very good variety of people who are speaking at our rally on Sunday that represent a lot of those groups too, because this is a really multifaceted issue that touches everyone, and we need to make sure that we hear all of the ways that it's going to impact people.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a lot of these people come from really marginalised communities, often will either pre-disabled or are disabled, or their primary breadwinner of the family is the one that is also experiencing this. So it does affect everybody. And I'm wondering, just to finish off, I know you're a doctor, and yeah, what would you like to, I guess, say to our listeners who are really passionate about this issue, but also how it affects you in your work?
So I guess what I would like to say to everyone is thank you so much for all of the support you've shown for this campaign. We're going to keep fighting, and we hope that you'll all keep fighting with us around this issue coming into the into next year, when the funding is going to run out in June. In terms of, I work in a public hospital, so I see the very direct day-to-day results of the underfunding of our public health system. I think this issue shows we can fight back. We can stand together as communities and win things if we stand together. And so I think that just shows what we need to do moving forward, and that is to build a campaign against healthcare austerity.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Liz. Yes. Such an important issue. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And that was Liz, who's a doctor and member of the Socialists in Healthcare, who joined us this week about the Save Care Health campaign updates, as well as the $1 million in funding that we've just received. And what to expect for the upcoming events this week. That's tomorrow, Friday, opposite the Peter Mac Hospital. That's a healthcare worker speak out. And Sunday, 23rd at 1 p.m, the Save Care Health Fitzroy. And we'll have all of that in our show notes as well.
But I won't be sworn at and I won't be bossed around. That includes them, the big bosses. They won't be bossing me around either. I will find a way.
Rents are through the roof. The cost of living is skyrocketing, and public housing is under attack. How do we fight back? Join us on Wednesday, the 26th of November, from 6 p.m. at RMIT University's City Campus for From Housing Crisis to Dwelling Justice, a free public event that gets to the heart of the housing struggle. Featuring the premiere of Bay Views for All, a documentary about the fight to save the Barrack Beacon public housing estate, and a panel discussion with public housing residents, activists, and experts, this is one you won't want to miss. Register for a free ticket at events.humanitix.com/crisis-2-justice.
It's never occurred to them they've actually got something valuable here.
Hands off public housing. A 3CR supporter.
You might have heard about the Community Radio Plus app, but it's only when you start using it that you'll wonder how you lived without it.
You can listen to us wherever you are, at home, work, driving,
on public transport, gardening, protesting, or even in the bath.
Just search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
You're tuned in to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and we are coming up to our final show segment for today's show, rather. We are joined by Dr. Simon Bradshaw, the COP31 lead at Greenpeace Australia Pacific, live from COP30 in Belém, Brazil, with updates from the conference as it reaches its close. Now, while Australia continues to angle for the privilege of hosting COP31, serious questions about climate finance commitments and concrete action on an end to fossil fuels remain unanswered. Simon has been a researcher, writer, and campaigner for climate action for over two decades, attending many rounds of international climate negotiations, and he was also formerly research director at Climate KLC Australia and a climate specialist with Oxfam. Good morning, Simon.
Very good morning. Good morning from Brazil. Good to be with you, Priya.
Yes, thanks very much for joining us across the massive distance and time difference. It is greatly appreciated. Now, I wanted to start off with by hearing a bit about some of the key issues that have been on the table at COP30, especially around climate finance and an end to fossil fuels, and how these have been building on discussions from previous conferences.
Yes, well, to give a bit of context, first of all, this COP obviously comes at an absolutely critical moment in the world's response to the climate crisis. And we've been seeing, you know, the signs of climate breakdown all around us. And we're here on the edge of the Amazon, which is, of course, one of the world's critical ecosystems that has been, you know, suffering tremendous damage, sadly, as from global heating. So front of mind here is that sense of urgency, is that sense of just how close we are to 1.5 degrees of warming and to crossing dangerous tipping points in the climate system. Now, ahead of this COP, countries submitted their new national action plans, or nationally determined contributions, as they're called in the jargon here. And it was very clear that those fall far short of the pace of collective action that we need to really avoid the worst impacts of climate change. So two of the really critical things being discussed here is, first of all, the global response plan that can help ensure we close that 1.3 degree emissions gap, you know, get climate pollution down much faster through this critical decade. And a key part of that, and perhaps the thing that's had the most attention here, is the idea of a roadmap to transition away from fossil fuels. This was put on the table at the start of the COP by the Brazilian president, and has been getting rightly a lot of attention. At this stage, there's around 80 countries that have thrown their weight behind that. That includes major fossil fuel producers like Colombia, like Norway. It includes, of course, many Pacific Island nations. It doesn't, at the moment, include Australia. So as you can imagine, there's been a big push to have Australia sign up to that. And as you mentioned, of course, finance is always a key topic at these negotiations, because it's that provision of adequate support from the advanced economies to other parts of the world to transition away from fossil fuels and also to adapt to the impacts of climate change that is so critical to making everything work and to ensure no one is left behind. As always, we're not seeing the progress on that front that we need to, but it is still several days to go here, so we'll have to see where we end up at the end of the week. But I think the focus here on fossil fuels is welcome. That will hopefully build on a landmark commitment made 3 years ago, 2 years ago, sorry, at COP28 in Dubai. And if we do come out of here with a, you know, meaningful step forward in the transition away from fossil fuels, of course, that would set things up for the next president, which may be Australia, to then have to really deliver that and step up and help ensure that we get concrete action from that new commitment.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is what I wanted to ask you about next, because, you know, as you've written about, as a lot of people have raised, the question really remains about that gap between pledge and action. And, you know, I was wondering if I could get your sense of how you've seen that challenge of converting climate pledges into climate action being addressed at COP30. And are you sensing any shifts in the concrete actions of major powers and especially major polluters? How can this issue of enforceability and actual concrete adherence to those pledges be meaningfully addressed?
Well, look, the ultimate goal and what was enshrined in the Paris Agreement and has been since, you know, affirmed as a legal obligation through the International Court of Justice is that we do everything possible to limit warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Now, that really is a lifeline to Pacific Island nations who have led the fight globally to ensure stronger action on climate change. And that's what we need to measure ourselves against. You know, how close are we getting to that all-important goal? Because every fraction of a degree of warming beyond that becomes more and more dangerous. Now, right now, if you tally up all those commitments from different countries, it gets us to around 2.6 degrees of warming by the end of this century. Now, that is, of course, far, far too dangerous, and we need to be bending that emissions curve down much faster. The positive thing to note there, though, is that's a better trajectory than we were on 10 years ago. So there is evidence that the Paris Agreement is working and that we are starting to bend that emissions curve, just not fast enough. But the other point, to come more directly to your question, is that 2.6 degrees of warming by the end of the century, that assumes all those existing commitments, all those nationally determined contributions or national targets that have been set, as inadequate as they are, that assumes they're fully implemented. Now, at this stage, a lot of countries are falling short of what they have said they're going to do. And those commitments, in turn, then sort of fall short of limiting warming to 1.5 degrees. So we've got to both strengthen those targets and actually make sure we meet and overachieve them. Now, there's two components to these negotiations. There's what's called the formal negotiated COP outcome. And then alongside that, there's what's called the action agenda. And that's where we see a lot of extra efforts to accelerate implementation of these commitments, all sorts of side deals, all sorts of sharing of knowledge. And a lot of the people here are really there for that, not just to negotiate, but to focus on solutions and doing what we can do collectively. So there's always some positive stories, always the seeds of hope here. But goodness, we do have so much more to do collectively.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess I did want to ask you about what the atmosphere has been like on the ground at COP30, especially among climate activist delegates, and how state representatives and local authorities have engaged specifically with concerns raised by Brazilian and international indigenous groups about climate justice issues, including deforestation, extractive industries, and land theft.
I think a couple of things to share there. I mean, being here it's a lot of mixed emotions, and it's all the things, really. It can be quite maddening when you realize the slow pace of negotiations and, you know, how detached that can be from the urgency of the climate crisis. It can be maddening when you see certain countries, typically the fossil fuel producers, really blocking the urgent progress that's needed. But it's also a place where global civil society does come together in an enormous show of strength and an enormous determination to hold the process accountable and to get every bit of progress we can. And there has rightly been here a big focus on Indigenous rights and Indigenous power and Indigenous strength. A lot of hope coming into this summit that would really be a big part of what we'd see here. Listening to a number of colleagues and friends, both here on the ground with Greenpeace Brazil, also the experiences of some of the First Nations communities from our own continent here, certainly hasn't lived up to what was hoped there. And we did see, I think, a very visceral show of frustration all through the week. And one positive there is there has been, through a presidential decree, designation of 10 new Indigenous territories within Brazil just over the last week. But it's also shown we have to do so much better should we be hosting COP in Australia next year to make sure those First Nations voices and that incredible wealth of knowledge of climate solutions and thousands of years of protecting country is really respected and valued as part of the process.
Absolutely. And I did want to ask about that question of hosting. So can you take us through some of the pitfalls but also opportunities of Australia if it's successful in its bid to host COP31? Because I know on the one hand, there are questions about whether this could be greenwashing at scale, but on the other, it could be a chance for international scrutiny and massive amounts of local pressure to actually ensure that the Australian government takes action on these crucial issues.
Look, there's both risks and there is a tremendous opportunity, and it would be quite a unique set of circumstances coming together if COP were to be held in Adelaide next year. And Australia really is, you know, ground zero for fossil fuel expansion. We are a fossil fuel giant. We've been a major supplier of coal and gas to the fast-growing economies of Southeast Asia, South and East Asia. But of course, we're also sitting on some of the world's best renewable energy potential, and Australia does at least have the aspiration to flip from being a fossil fuel heavyweight to being a clean energy powerhouse, and in doing so to play an outsized role in the world's response to climate change. The other things that would be really key is, of course, and I think this is the real attraction of having a COP in Australia, is the opportunity to really back in and support this long legacy of Pacific climate leadership in driving the phase out of fossil fuels and efforts to limit warming to 1.5 degrees. We're, of course, also going to be on the continent that's home to the oldest living cultures, who, as we've just said, whose knowledge and wisdom is so critical in driving solutions. And, of course, it comes right in the middle of this absolute make-or-break decade for climate action. So put all that together and you have an almost perfect storm of circumstances. It's almost a little microcosm of the global challenge. And the opportunity there to really accelerate action is enormous. So that's the potential. But the risk, as you've already flagged, that this becomes, you know, just a big clean energy trade fair, just a effort to attract more investment into Australia, which of course is important. But, you know, without really getting serious about the managed wind down of fossil fuels and really being prepared to get behind longstanding Pacific priorities. But look, I think it's going to be up to all of us as a civil society and all of those of us who are around the process to hold it accountable and to make sure that we make the absolute most of what will be, you know, a once-in-a-generation opportunity we're potentially going to have to be really playing a positive leadership role in the world's response to climate change.
Yeah, I appreciate you taking us through that mixed bag of opportunities and concerns, and definitely important to have the opportunity, especially for Pacific Island leadership and for delegations from Pacific Island nations, to have a strong presence if it were to be held in Australia, and to really shine a spotlight on the actions that need to happen in this region. Now, as we wrap up, Simon, I wanted to ask you about what's left at COP30 and, what are you looking forward to as the conference comes to a close?
Well, there's still a few days to run, and often a lot of things do go right down to the wire. What, of course, we're dearly hoping we come out of here with is agreements on a roadmap to transition away from fossil fuels, with that work being kickstarted here and then the baton passed potentially to Australia and the Pacific next year to finish that vitally important work. That would really set up the road to COP 31 really being about the phase out of fossil fuels. There are other things that need to happen here as well, assurances of more funding to communities that need it most, all sorts of other technical negotiations that go on, for example, on how we're going to organize the next global stocktake of climate efforts, as it's called. But we have to come out of here both with new commitments, a sense of renewed hope in the multilateral system, which of course has taken quite a battering the last few years, and just a determination to drive forwards. And we, of course, at a really critical moment where every decision here matters, but we want to come out of here really with a sense of hope and possibility and some renewed momentum in the global response to climate change. There's a few days to run here. I do have to say, yes, there are far too many fossil fuel offers falling around. There is far too much blocking that goes on the major fossil fuel producers. But there is so much determination from those on the front lines of the climate crisis, no more so than those within our own region who really are giving it everything they can all through the night to make sure we come out of here with the best outcome possible. So all power and strength to them for these what will be an exhausting last few days.
Absolutely. And look, we have no choice but to keep up the fight. And thank you so much again, Simon, for joining us from Belém.
Pleasure to be with you. Thank you, Priya.
And that was Dr. Simon Bradshaw, the COP31 lead at Greenpeace Australia Pacific, who was speaking with us live from COP30 in Belém, Brazil, with updates from the conference as it reaches its close. Now, while Australia continues to angle for the privilege of hosting COP31, questions still remain about climate finance commitments and concrete action on an end to fossil fuels. Simon has been a researcher, writer, and campaigner for climate action for over two decades and was formerly research director at Climate KLC Australia and a climate specialist with Oxfam. You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast. It is 8:27 in the morning.
And I don't believe in fighting today in any one front, but on all fronts. In fact, I'm a black nationalist freedom fighter.
This country is a nation of thieves.
Now, we're never going to get justice here in these filthy racist courts here.
Our people have been massacred, and we're not supposed to grieve for that. We've got to do something more drastic if we're serious about this.
Move over or we going to move on over you.
Yilliman with Kieran Stewart-Asherton on 3CR. Dives deep into Indigenous resistance and global anti-colonial struggles. Featuring frontline activists, it confronts Australia's identity, challenges power structures, and fuels revolutionary discourse. Wednesdays, 12 to 1 p.m.
Now, that is about all we've got time for on Thursday Breakfast this week, but we'll just quickly take you through what we had on our show today. First up, we heard from Pauline Vatuna sharing reflections on the work of disabled oracles and the impact of revolutionary disability activist Alice Wong. We also heard from Fiona York from Housing for the Aged Action Group on older tenants' experiences in the rental market and the impact of the public housing high-rise redevelopment program. We heard a speech by May Saif from Free Palestine Melbourne outside the community protest held against Israeli psytrance duo Infected Mushroom from earlier this month. We were joined by Liz from Socialists in Healthcare with campaign updates from Save CoHealth. And finally, we're joined by Dr. Simon Bradshaw, who's the COP31 lead at Greenpeace Australia Pacific, live from COP30 in Belém, Brazil. Now, remember, Beyond the Bar CD launch is happening tonight, Thursday the 20th of November, from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the Gering Centre, Eddy Court in Abbotsford. We'd love to see you there. It's going to be an incredible night and really encourage you to come down if you can. Why not? You're going to knock off between 5, 5:30. What else do you have to do on a Thursday evening? Come down to the Gering Centre at Eddy Court, Abbotsford, and hear from the incredible crew of Mob who have put this together, hear excerpts from the CDs, and yeah, just enjoy the atmosphere. It'll be a wonderful evening and really hope that you can come down. We'll catch you next week on Thursday Breakfast.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical independent bookseller and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find NIBS in the basement of Trades Hall in Victoria Street, Carlton, or check them out at nibs.org.au to find more information about upcoming discussions and events.